Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today we go from live cutting-edge contemporary music in a small cafe to the music of Johnny Cash. Before we walk the line, though, dancer choreographer Helen Simoneau was asking her dancers to put it all on the line for Paper Wings. It's local modern dance that the great Baryshnikov calls cool moves. Composer Eric Schwartz brings the hip new music scene of Brooklyn to the Triad with Forecast Music's Brooklyn Sounds, Copeland Meets the Moderns. And they say action speaks louder than words. Authoring action has its cake and eats it too, engaging audiences, empowering youth, and bringing about change all through the power of the written and spoken word. Paisley 10th grader Nani Christine Egbuna fights the power with Bethany Chafin. And musician-songwriter Richard Boyd of the Bo Stevens celebrates the birthday of the legendary Man in Black with 10 outstanding local bands during the 12th annual Cash Bash. And you're invited. He chats with Eddie Garcia. Get ready to walk the line next on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Forecast Music was founded in 2001 in what has come to be known as the epicenter of contemporary music in America, Brooklyn, New York. Forecast, the adventurous new music group, is now based in the Triad, where it draws on several of the world's finest composers and performers living right here in North Carolina. The Forecast mission, to present new and innovative American concert music of varied aesthetic visions in relaxed, alternative performance spaces, as well as traditional concert venues. It's a new way to listen to new music. Each program is typically about an hour in length, and depending on the venue, you can often enjoy a nice glass of wine or craft brew as the unusual new sounds waft over you. Brooklyn Sounds, Copeland Meets the Moderns will feature the chamber music of 20th century masters and Brooklyn natives Aaron Copeland and John Carigliano. Their chamber music pieces will be performed alongside contemporary works from the ever-expanding and incredibly hip classical music scene in New York's most populous borough, Brooklyn. I caught up with Forecast co-founder, pianist, composer Eric Schwartz, and we spoke about their upcoming performance at the Community Arts Cafe in Winston-Salem. Forecast comprised of some of the world's finest composers and all living right here in North Carolina. What sorts of skills vault a person into that? I mean, you're a composer and a performer into that realm of one of the world's best. And what sorts of things raise them to that level?
Sure. I mean, I think there's no question but that in any aesthetic fields, an art of music or art of any kind, there's a lot of subjectivity. I mean, being of great quality, I think, is really just a matter, at least from our perspective as Forecast Music, speaking only for ourselves and not for music historians or anything like that, it's just people who write music we really, really want to hear. And in the case of some of the artists we work with, I think of like a Ken Frizzell or a Larry Dillon, some of our local fabulous composers. These are people who just write scores of wonderful pieces that we love to listen to. We don't love to analyze them. I mean, we might analyze them in a certain context, but what we really care about is pieces that are fabulous to listen to, that represent us as 21st century humans. And I think there's a lot of people doing that here in the Triad, here in North Carolina, and here in the United States. We think of Europe as the center of concert music, but I don't know if that's so true in the 21st century anymore. I think it's arguable.
And along with that, a focus on a variety of sounds, varied aesthetic visions in relaxed, alternative performance spaces, as well as traditional venues. And wondering why do you select these aspects of music performance as a Forecast mission?
Right. Well, before I lived in North Carolina, I cut my teeth in New York City and I went to a lot of concerts. And I specifically, as a young composer, went to a whole bunch of contemporary music concerts. And I discovered a few models that I thought were somewhat unfortunate. Squishing as many new pieces as humanly possible onto programs, having people in very conventional, very lovely, ornate, classical spaces of some kind that just didn't fit, you know, distorted electric guitars and sort of the idioms of modern musicians. And all these things, you know, I had some great concert experiences in those things. Going to see the New York Philharmonic play a piece by Steve Reich is a great experience, but it's not quite the same as, I don't know, going to the Community Arts Cafe and seeing a chamber music that specializes in that music in an intimate, sort of friendly atmosphere with a beer in your hand.
Giving people a chance to contextualize some of these newer sounds is pairing brand new, spanking new works with some 20th century classics.
Right. That's something, that was sort of part of the evolving mission of Forecast Music. As the ensemble developed, we have always been very – our one bit of dogma, I suppose, and I like to think of ourselves, as you mentioned, aesthetic variety. We have no aesthetic dogma. We just like people who are alive.
Is that so much to ask?
I mean, as a musician, I have nothing but the greatest respect for the pantheon of composers, recently deceased or long deceased. But there's so much emphasis on that. It makes it a museum art form. And so Forecast had always been very dogmatic about performing living composers. It was eventually discovered that one of the best ways, one of the best entries for people into living composers was the music of our immediate forebearers, people like Igor Stravinsky, people like Aaron Copland. People who are so directly influential on our work are more familiar with the audiences. That really contextualizes a lot of the material. When you can hear something of the 20th century, it sort of makes a little makes 21st century music make a little bit more sense.
Yeah, it's just connecting that lineage sometimes. It seems like this concert, Brooklyn Sounds, Copland meets the Moderns, seems to do just that. And mm-hmm. Talk about putting the program together, for starters.
You know, we wanted to stay true to Forecast Music's mission of presenting primarily live composers. In this particular instance, decided to shift our focus onto our ancestral home, if you will, Brooklyn, New York, where Forecast Music was born well over a decade ago now, 2001, in conjunction with the Rinalda House American Moderns exhibit, which is on loan from the Brooklyn Art Museum, the sort of serendipitous connections here. When we were putting together the program, it was decided the anchor of the program would be in that 20th century classics idiom, and that particularly would be the greatest 20th century American master in the field of music, arguably, Aaron Copland. Somebody profoundly influential on myself as a composer, and certainly someone influential, I think, on all American composers to some degree. So we started with Aaron Copland as sort of the anchor of the concert. We'll be performing two of his works from really spanning his career, early, middle, and very late pieces by Copland. And then we wanted to make a nod to a living master, a real figure who's central to contemporary art music, and that would be John Corleano, who was born and raised in beautiful Brooklyn, New York, and certainly where we're born and raised is nothing if not informative on our oeuvres. And then the other figures, we just kind of did a swath. We have a Derek Bermel born in the 1960s, an Eric Schwartz born in the 1970s, and a Timo Andrus born in the 1980s, all of whom, myself included, spent our formative years, our formative creative periods in Brooklyn and incredibly influenced by that. So we have this real swath of the music being made today in Brooklyn through, you know, good old Aaron Copland, 1900.
That's perfect. Well, let's talk a little bit about Aaron Copland. Just at first start, I mean, father of American music, maybe not, but what made this guy so great?
Sure. I mean, Copland is such an important figure. I think in American music, our real core ancestry lies in Charles Ives and Aaron Copland. And I feel, personally, Charles Ives represents the strictly avant-garde, rugged individualism. But Aaron Copland is really the figure who divorced concert music from Europe. To a certain degree, which is ironic, of course, because he studied in Paris. But Copland really came up with the sound, and really this was by force of will. He really worked at this throughout his career, came up with the sound I think most clearly associated with an American classical or concert idiom and most disassociated with a strictly European model. And he did that in over the course of his entire career, starting with, you know, his jazz-influenced music in the 20s, and then, of course, the real Americana sound of the late 30s, 40s, and 50s, your Appalachian Springs and all that good stuff.
Well, let's dive into the program, beginning with it's a duo, the duo for flute and piano by Aaron Copland. And in this one, we just ticked off Appalachian Spring. I mean, you get kind of a mix of sounds of a little Appalachian Spring, a little Rodeo. When did this piece fall into his output?
This is a fascinating piece to me. There's the kind of the story about Aaron Copland is that, you know, he started off as this jazzy avant-garde composer, and then he became the most accessible composer in the history of the universe with pieces like Appalachian Spring and Billy the Kid and all those mid-century ballets. And then at the end of his career, or at the end of his creative career at least, he wrote serial music, scary, scary atonal music. But this piece, the duo for flute and piano, is actually from 1971. And it is this wildly accessible, fun, beautiful, very Appalachian Spring, mid-century Copland-esque work. It doesn't really fit that chronology that people tend to associate with Copland. And it is just a great work. I mean, it is very accessible, jubilant melodies, very, I suppose the adjective would be Copland-esque.
And then three theater songs by John Carigliano, and people may recall John Carigliano's music for, I guess it's the film score for The Red Violin, and he wrote a fantastic, really edgy clarinet concerto.
Yeah, it's a great piece.
But this piece, I dare say, John's having a little bit of fun with this one.
It's such a frisky ditty. I don't think of him first and foremost as a wit. Perhaps that's that. Perhaps that's not fair. I've met him a couple of times, and he seemed very nice. But this is a funny, silly set of pieces, very contemporary. It's from the late 90s, early 21st century. I believe the songs are from 97 and 2001. But they're a lot of fun. They're cabaret-esque. They're really are meant to be sort of light classical, and they're silly, goofy, good times. And I think that's great. I mean, this is a Pulitzer Prize-winning, Oscar-winning master composer. But these are fun pieces. I think people will enjoy them.
And then, Eric, you're on the program. One of your works, this it creates an image immediately, Waking Underwater, and for voice and percussion. Interesting combination. And tell me about the piece.
Okay. This was a piece that was commissioned by a great, great guy named Trevor Saint, who is a specialist on the extended-range glockenspiel. And when he came to me interested in commissioning a piece for extended-range glockenspiel, I immediately was horrified and couldn't imagine what on earth I was going to do.
Well, remind us first off, what is a regular old glockenspiel?
Well, a regular old glockenspiel is a it's a mallet instrument. It's the highest pitched mallet instrument. It is very, very highly pitched, sometimes called the orchestral bells. It's got little metal bars that resonate real, real high frequencies. It's about 2.5 octaves in range. And so just trying to figure out what to do with it, I created my own little sort of theatrical ditty incorporating vocals, using the glockenspiel, but also incorporating the sounds of amplified water. The performer or performers, in the case of the version we'll be doing with both vocalist and glockenspiel player, there is an option for the glockenspiel player to sing themselves, uses the sound of water being sort of played with and worked with under amplification during the performance. So it's got all kinds of stuff going on, and I feel myself like I did about as much wonderful stuff as I could possibly figure out how to do with the basic instrumentation of extended range glockenspiel and all that. And it's a piece I'm really, really very happy with, and I think people will enjoy it. I will say in certain performances we have had a sort of a splash zone situation for people in the front rows, but we have promised Ronaldo House that we will not be wetting their stage or their patrons. So in this particular performance, we will not have a splash zone situation.
Interesting story behind orbit design. We should point out forecast. I mean, you've been known to also challenge listeners, and this mm-hmm. is one of those pieces that in a good way, that, that does just that.
Certainly. Derek Bermel is a wonderful composer and clarinetist. This particular piece is kind of, I suppose it's his Cage piece. It's really John Cage mm-hmm. specifically, famous, crazy, mid-century, well, through the 90s, American composer. This is Derek's really improvisational, sort of a guided improvisation. There's certain parameters that the composer establishes, and then the performers get to do what they want within those parameters. And we will be doing all kinds of lovely, exciting, and just plain quirky things within the confines of Bermel's score. But this is essentially an improvisational piece, something we don't always associate with classical music, but we improvise too. Dang it.
Great.
To get the musician's take on what it's like tackling the music of living composers, I spoke with Forecast's John R. Beck. John's a chamber musician extraordinaire, but he's also a principal percussionist with the Winston-Salem Symphony, University of North Carolina School of the Arts and Wake Forest University percussion instructor, and president of the Percussive Arts Society. You've played lots and lots of contemporary music. What jazzes you up about playing new works and just being involved in that?
Well, for us as percussionists, it's often a matter of problem solving. The composers will write what they hear in their heads, and we have to figure out, particularly in terms of Eric's piece, the Glockenspiel, what kind of mallet we're going to use. He tells us it's a 4-octave instrument, which are rare. It's extended range. But am I going to use a hard rubber mallet, a hard plastic mallet, brass? What kind of colors am I going to try to get out of this instrument? And then I have the interaction with a singer and a pan of water. So trying to wrap your head around how to react with those sounds, what's appropriate. So there are lots of choices that I make. And Eric is a kind of composer who's very hands-off. He says, whatever you think, I'll let you know. And so he doesn't give the performer a lot of direction, which to us is kind of fun. It leads to a lot of experimentation.
Yeah. I mean, you're in a sense, you're a composer too in this. I mean, you're definitely arranging this in a way that makes sense to you musically.
Very much. You know, yeah. All the choices we make really determine the sound we're going to get, which may be completely different than what the composer thought he was hearing in his head. I bring lots of mallets. Let's put it that way. I'll have a bag of mallets at the rehearsal with the composer.
Yeah, that just from mallets alone, listeners may not be aware that, I mean, just the variety of timbres you get or overtones that are released going from a metal mallet to, was it yarn used on certain mallets?
They can be covered in yarn or uncovered rubber or plastic, and the different hardnesses, I believe the term is durameter, of rubber that measures the hardness, and it runs the spectrum.
Wow.
Also, where you strike on the bar makes a difference, since there are nodal points on a Glockenspiel bar. If I hit it directly in the center, it's over a note. If I hit it just off center, I get a slightly different set of overtones excited.
How about that? You mentioned the water element here, and of course the title is Waking Underwater. Talk about the use of water. I mean, that's not very common from even in 21st century music uses. How is it used in this piece?
The performance can be a duet or a solo. I'm glad we're doing it as a duet, since I don't have to dip my hands in the water and then use wet hands to play my instrument. But the performer plays in the water, literally like a child would play in a bathtub. And you listen to those sounds. There's some speaking by the vocalist and some singing. And then the Glockenspiel adds a harmonic texture, not necessarily melodic, which is also unusual for us. Typically in an orchestra, if we're playing Glockenspiel, we're playing a melody.
Is it you, a Glockenspiel, a singer, and a bucket of water? How's it going to look?
The first time we played the piece, I think we used a clear pan of water or a bowl so that the audience could actually see the hands being dipped into the water. There was a visual element to this. And much of Eric's music is theatrical in that way. It's not just what you're hearing, but it's the act of playing. So how the percussionist and the singer interact with each other well, the singer is playing in the water or murmuring or making sounds that are not necessarily characteristic of a soprano, that interplay is part of the piece.
Okay. Another work on the program equally is interesting in terms of the thought that went into the idea of this piece, referring to Derek Bermell's Orbit Design. And it's a nice mix of composed elements and chance music, in a sense.
In the instructions for this piece, and there are only printed instructions, no notation, he quotes John Cage, who said, "My favorite music is the music I haven't heard yet. I don't hear the music I write. I write in order to hear the music I haven't yet heard."
There's a concept.
And Cage really broke the doors wide open for exploring what is music. What is that question? What can constitute music? In this case, the performers choose parameters to play. At our first rehearsal, I chose a Cage mathematical structure of 4-3-2-1-2-3-4, which he uses in some of his constructions for percussion ensemble. The element that I changed was the instrumentation. So I played it on a maraca, I played it on a woodblock, I played it on a cowbell, I played it on a flexitone, which is a metal instrument that sounds very comical. I played it inside the piano. Well, the other instrumentalists all chose their own set of parameters, and literally we orbited one another walking around the pianist. And like celestial bodies, as we got closer to one another, our interactions changed. And so this piece is based on that idea that when two bodies are interacting, it can be very predictable. But when you add a third body, it becomes very difficult to predict. I'm definitely not a physicist or an astrologist. This piece is very much based on theories of Newton and Newton's laws of gravity. So we each choose our own elements, our own little orbiting world, and then as we interact with one another, the piece evolves, and it's different every time it's performed.
Forecast musician, percussionist John R. Beck. Before John, I spoke with composer and Forecast Music co-founder Eric Schwartz. On Sunday, February 23rd, Forecast will feature the chamber music of 20th century masters and Brooklyn natives Aaron Copland and John Corigliano. Their chamber music pieces will be performed alongside contemporary works from the ever-expanding and hip classical music scene in New York's most populous borough. Brooklyn Sounds, Copland Meets the Moderns, begins at 3 o'clock in the Rinalda House Museum of American Art, where you can still see the Traveling Brooklyn Museum exhibit, American Moderns, 1910 to 1960, from O'Keeffe to Rockwell. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. When we come back from this short break, it'll be time to dance with Helen Cimino Dance next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and today, Eddie Garcia joins the Bo Stevens' Richard Boyd to salute the life and music of the late, great Johnny Cash, and Bethany Chafin joins Authoring Action to pay tribute to the power of the written word. But first, in the words of the great David Bowie, let's dance. Helen Cimino Dance is bringing her exciting new original choreography to downtown Winston-Salem. It's a short program with live music, both classical and contemporary, and it'll feature two dances, a duet that Helen began while attending her company's recent residency at the Baryshnikov Art Center in New York, and Paper Wings, commissioned by the American Dance Festival. Helen says Paper Wings was originally choreographed for 19 dance students of varied abilities. She's recently restaged the work for 11 professional dancers.
I was interested in each dancer making their presence visible. How can you make your presence visible? How can you show me who you are through your dancing? And that's sort of what rooted it for me and how we made decisions was based on, is this going to push this idea forward of making your presence visible so that we can see the group together, but we are all individuals within this group.
Were you dealing with, ideas of nonconformity at all? All the women are dressed wearing the same mm-hmm. outfit. It looks like a throwback from the 50s in a sense, which I thought was kind of interesting. And yet they slowly emerge from this mass of women to do their own thing.
Yeah, I made the choice to have them wear pink, to have them wear skirts. I wanted it to tie in a little bit to a uniform, a female uniform, and then play a little bit with what is expected. How are we supposed to look? How are we supposed to stand? And there's a section in there, it's a quintet, where these dancers come out and they're dancing to the sound of snapping. And there's a lot of batmas, just throwing your leg up and slapping it down. And that section was what I refer to as the rocket section.
I can see that, yeah.
So there's a lot of slipping in and out of these places where we're going to look in this direction and we're going to make this pose because this is what the picture is supposed to look like. If you're wearing your pearls and you're having your debutante picture taken, like, what would it look like? How am I supposed to pose? And being very aware that you're being viewed and you're being judged for how you look. And then from that, they break out and then they have these solos that are very much like, well, this is what I think about that. These moments of slapping your foot down and really asserting yourself and drawing the line.
I found one of the powerful gestures and also beautiful, all 19 dancers balancing on their shoulder blades with their legs straight up in the air, but not rigidly so, kind of blowing in the breeze like wings and all together at a similar angle. Just very powerful. How did that image come to you?
That is a good question. It is the end of the first section. And the first section is just very physical, a lot of sweeping across the stage, large dancing, very very exciting section, I think. And at the end, I wanted it to all kind of distill down to a very quiet moment and a moment where they are all together doing one thing. And also on the stage, I wanted it to be for them to become an image rather than for them to be individuals. I wanted them to all be one thing together. And so I had the thought that they would have this moment of calm where their legs would be like grass just blowing in the wind, just to have that quiet moment together.
Dancer, choreographer Helen Simoneau. On Thursday, February 27th and Friday the 28th, she and her company, Helen Simoneau Dance, will present two of Helen's original choreographies with original music by Andy Hasenflug and Johann Sebastian Bach's Sonata for Violin and Harpsichord performed by Mallarmé Chamber Players. The dance concerts begin at 7:30 in the Hanesbrands Theater in downtown Winston-Salem. You'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. It's time for intermission number two, but fear not, we'll be back in 60 seconds with some really cool stuff. First, Bethany Chafin, authoring Action, and Paisley IB Magnet School's Nonni Christine Egbuna remind us just what the written and spoken word can accomplish. And then Eddie Garcia and Bo Stevens musician-songwriter Richard Boyd preview this year's Cash Bash and celebrate the Man in Black. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. A little later on in the show, Eddie Garcia is going to remind us what made Johnny Cash so great. But right now, Bethany Chafin has authoring action.
Nonni Christine Egbuna has quite a voice. The 15-year-old 10th grader at Paisley IB Magnet School is a member of Authoring Action. The nonprofit aims to harness the power of storytelling through writing, dance, spoken word, and film, and the teens involved with Authoring Action are nurtured as writers and as advocates of social change. Authoring Action's third annual winter retrospective begins this weekend at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art. Engagements begin at 6 p.m. on Saturday, February 22nd, and at 3 p.m. on Sunday, February 23rd. The activities continue next weekend at the same times on March 1st and 2nd. Proceeds benefit Authoring Action and SICA. I spoke with Nonni about the power of writing and the power of sharing.
Fighting a wash of the mind. Well, at Authoring Action, we say, I am an author, I admit, I accept, and I share. And so the writing process, or the process itself, is not done until you leave the stage. You know what I mean? It starts when you pick up the pen or you pick up your computer and start typing the piece, and it finishes when you leave the stage, because words don't matter unless they are shared. You know, and so spoken word to me is so important. It's one of the most effective ways and methods of self-expression. It is a great way to let your voice be heard, because, you know, you're not just ranting, you're not just on a soapbox, you know, but you're saying words and you're giving your opinion in a way that matters and in a way that changes things. We try to speak from the place from which we wrote the piece. So, you know, if I was really upset when I wrote the piece, I'll try to speak it. I'll go back to that place and I'll speak it in a way. I'm upset about this. I want you to hear what I'm upset about. You know, if it's a happy piece, I tend not to write happy pieces. I tend to write, my pieces are a little serious, but I write them in a way that changes things. I want to bring about change when I speak.
That's great. And I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you what kind of feedback you've gotten and whether or not you've had an opportunity to see that change that you're hoping to right. inspire and impart and share.
I get tons of people coming up to me after shows, you know, and a lot of them will be like, oh, you're so powerful. You're such a great speaker. And, you know, that's great to hear. But what I like to hear is, wow, I've been waiting for someone to say that, you know, I want to go out and do something about this, which I do get at a lot of shows. I actually wrote a piece, and I wrote it for the Winston-Salem Centennial. It was in the paper the next day. It was a pretty intense piece, because I don't tend to write, you know, pieces that celebrate where we are. I want to go further, you know? And so the next morning, I looked at the paper, and it was in the paper that, you know, Nani Egbuna, a 15-year-old from Paisley IB Magnet School, wrote a piece, and she said the event had a somber moment when Nani Egbuna talked about Winston-Salem's Jim Crow years. She said that we've come far, but we still have a long ways to go. And some people did not like that I was bringing up the Jim Crow years. I think they felt that I was bringing the event down and it was supposed to celebrate. And I don't think I was bringing it down. I just want everyone to understand, you know, we still have such a ways to go. There's so much improvement that can be made. And so that's the kind of feedback I've gotten. I love getting feedback, especially while I'm doing a piece. I love hearing reactions. It keeps me going when I'm doing a piece. I do not like doing pieces and the audience is just quiet. That's the worst.
So you brought something interesting up, the idea of what you're doing on stage when you are presenting a piece mm-hmm. and what's happening in the audience. And I understand that Authoring Action doesn't really like to use the term, or they prefer not to use the term, performance.
Right.
And I want to ask, what do you use instead?
We use the word engagement. And the difference, performance is more of, okay, I'm going to get on stage, I'm going to say what I have to say, and I'm going to leave. And engagement, to me, the key thing about engagement is eye contact. And, you know, you're really talking, you're having a conversation with your audience. It's not just reciting your piece. We say our pieces and we mean what we say. And that way, you know, when I look an audience member in the eyes and, you know, I see people crying, I see, if it's something funny, I see someone laughing. I meet their eyes and they, you know, nod and they're like, yeah, girl, like, I understand what you're saying. That's what engagement is, because what's the point, you know, of just going up there and reciting a piece? What's the point of just going up there speaking so fast that no one understands what you're saying? You know, you have to slow down. You have to mean what you say. You have to go back to the place from which you wrote it. You have to really say, look, I have something to say. You're going to listen. And I need a change to come because of it.
Is it hard to go back to the place from which you wrote it? Because you're talking about not always writing happy pieces. Yeah. What's that feeling like of trying to kind of recreate that?
That's one thing that I do struggle with, is really, really just going back to that place and really putting myself into the piece. I've seen myself grow, and it is really difficult to go back to the place from which you wrote the piece, just because it's not always a happy place. And even if it is a happy place, you know, it's a different day. You could be feeling a different way. But if you really just sit down and look at your piece and say, I wrote this, you know what I mean? So I know what I'm talking about. And so that's just how you have to really get yourself into the piece, clear your mind of whatever else, and go tell the audience what you have to say.
So it sounds like you're very aware of owning your piece, mm-hmm. but of also making it accessible enough so someone in the audience can sort of
right.
feel it right. and understand it.
Everyone can interpret it a different way. I try not to leave too much room for interpretation, because a lot of my pieces, like I said, are to bring about a specific change, you know, to eliminate racism or to make sure that women get paid the same as men, to make sure that Black worker gets paid the same as his white coworker. You know, that's often my pieces are about specific things like that.
We've been putting so much in and getting nothing back. I guess that's why we're questioning. Is it something that we lack? We live in a generation where things move slow, but we live fast. Are we just wasting our time? When will it be time for us to move on? When will it be time for us to move on? We've been putting so much in and getting nothing back. I guess that's why we're questioning. Is it something that we lack? We live in a generation where things move slow, but we live fast. Are we just wasting our time? When will it be time for us to move on? When will it be time for us to move on?
Is that you singing?
Yes, it is me and a girl that was in the organization named Karee Clark.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Could you tell us a bit about the inspiration behind that piece?
It was my first summer, actually, and I had written a piece called Welcome, and really just a piece listing all my problems with this generation. And I know that sounds crazy, but I wrote the piece and I just really wanted to get that out. And that was one of the first pieces I wrote. And it was an ensemble that was, there was a guy named Justin talking about gay rights, you know, fighting for all this different type of stuff. There was a girl talking about, you know, environmental issues and how she wants global warming to stop, how she wants us to, you know, not have such a big footprint and all that stuff. So it was just such a major ensemble. And so Mr. Nathan said, I want a song with that. It's a really, really short song. But I wrote it and I was like, you know, I don't think this needs any more. I think this is what the song has to say, and this will go so well with the other pieces. And we engaged it at that show, and we recorded it a couple weeks later.
So was the music sort of done? Did you play Move On underneath the other piece that you had written, or did you work them together?
We actually started the ensemble with the song. Sometimes if there's a song, you know, it'll be interwoven with the pieces, so someone will, you know, be engaging their piece, and then it'll break and someone will sing a song and then another piece. But I think we just put the song at the beginning of the ensemble, and then it was just peace. You could say I have my head screwed on straight, that these are the shoulders of a soldier, that there is power in my eyes, and in my mind lies the lemons that life has yet to give. I am the future. My intelligence shoots daggers through anybody who wants to challenge me intellectually. I throw the weight of this generation in a Jan's port, and I carry it on my back because I just don't trust anyone else with it. I am an original. Search my name in a thesaurus and you will find nothing. There is no one else like me. I am a star. Laced in copper skin, I'm more like gold. My roots were dug in Crayola purple plains, the color of royalty. I am a queen.
This is getting a little theoretical, but I know something that you mention in the piece that you wrote for the centennial, and then something that I also picked up on in the song Move On, is the idea of harmony. And first of all, because the harmony in Move On is absolutely beautiful. And like I said, you reference the idea of harmony being perfect in your piece for the centennial. And could you give me some of your thoughts on that idea, on that concept?
Yes. Not to sound cliche, but honestly, if we all just came together, it is ridiculous how much we could change and how much farther we could go, because there is so much to be done. And I don't like the concept of just, you know, oh, look, MLK did all that for us, or Malcolm X or Rosa Parks, you know, they did all that for us. But I'm just like, you know, there's so much more we could do, and we can do it as a unit if we come together and work in harmony and work and collaborate with each other and just cooperate with each other and love each other. I mean, there's so much that we can do, and we can go, I mean, beyond anyone's dreams. We can really just work and make the world a better place, make the city a better place, you know, make our schools, our households better places.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
Nani Christine Egbuna is a 10th grader at Paisley IB Magnet School, and this is her second year with Authoring Action. She and her fellow Authoring Action peers will engage audiences this weekend and next at the 3rd Annual Winter Retrospective. The event will take place at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, and tickets are available online. For more information and to see a video of Nani's work, visit our website at WFDD.org, and once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
That's Bethany Chafin. I'm David Ford, and this, well, it just doesn't get any better than this. Take it away, Eddie.
There's an engine at the station, and the whistle blows my name. It's calling, 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 come and get aboard the train. My baby's
I'm thinking that voice needs no introduction, but just in case, that's the immortal Johnny Cash, a.k.a. the Man in Black. The music of Mr. Cash will be celebrated on February 28th and March 1st at the Garage in downtown Winston-Salem. It's two evenings that my guest Richard Boyd has christened Cash Bash, and it's celebrating its 12th year. With an impressive bill of performers from a multitude of genres, including rockabilly, country, punk, metal, surf, and nearly everything in between, it's a duo of nights that any music lover will enjoy. The Bo Stevens frontman and Winston-Salem honky-tonk singer extraordinaire Richard Boyd stopped by WFDD to fill us in on the Cash Bash details.
With my guitar beating rhythm to the click-clack.
So why was it Johnny Cash, and what made you want to do it a night in tribute to him?
Me and a friend of mine, Kathy Clark, I was talking about my love for all things Johnny Cash. And I said, you know, somebody needs to do a Johnny Cash tribute show. She was involved with PS211 at the time.
Which now Cranky's.
Which is now Cranky's. It's been known as Cranky's, the Warehouse, PS211. PS211 was actually a nonprofit that was formed within the warehouse, and they were responsible for doing arts installations and also shows. And she was involved with that, and she said, I can get a night right around his birthday, and we'll just do it. And it was us, the Flies, which was at the time Andy Mabe and Jimmy Trimmer doing rockabilly, and Truck Stop Preachers out of Charlotte. So we set it up where, you know, you come, you do your own kind of music, but you have to do two Johnny Cash songs. You don't have to do it exactly like Johnny Cash did it, but you can do it any way you want to. Had a great time thinking it was just probably going to be a one-off thing. The next year somebody said, well, are you going to do it again? And I thought to myself, why not? So I did. Ended up moving it to the Garage. From there, it's just grown.
So why do you think it's grown every year? And I mean, what's kept it growing, you know, 12 times?
Johnny Cash's death was, I think, something that motivated people to pay tribute to him. And the fact that he just left an amazing amount of music behind that spanned genres, really. I mean, you can talk to someone who's in a punk rock band and they love Johnny Cash. You can talk to somebody who's in a country band, they love Johnny Cash. Basically, across the board, Johnny Cash is revered. And so I think that's part of the allure. Secondly, I think it was because it didn't matter what kind of band you were in. It didn't have to be a country band. So you got a variety, and people enjoyed that. And it just became a really energetic, fun time, and it just grew from there. Of course, right about the time that the movie Walk the Line came out, it just went crazy.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds because you're mine. I walk the line.
So what's the most unexpected genre you've had participating?
This year and the last couple years, we've had an actual instrumental band.
Oh, really?
Yeah, called Fat Links, and they're out of Chapel Hill. And they are like surfy, surf rock kind of thing, but they've done some incredible things with Johnny Cash tunes, using surf guitar and also keyboards and accordion. And it's just been quite fun. There's been many fun bands like that over the years and fun moments. There's a band out of Richmond that plays quite often called the Gojira Experiment. And I'm not quite sure how to explain their genre. It's got some funk, has a little bit of rockabilly to it, and metal, all sort of combined. Mm-hmm. But here they are up on stage doing Cry, Cry, Cry by Johnny Cash, a song that he made famous back in the 50s.
Yeah.
And the way they do it is unlike anything Johnny Cash would have ever done. But it works, and it's amazing to see that. And I think that's one of the things that makes people enjoy coming out to Cash Bash is that you don't know exactly what you're going to see. You're not going to see Johnny Cash tribute band up there doing exactly Johnny Cash, exactly the way he did it. But you're going to see folks up there who really honestly love to perform and are good musicians, and they love Johnny Cash, and they're doing Johnny Cash their way.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it's straighter, like my band, the Bo Stevens. You know, we're more straight country band, so it's a little more recognizable as Johnny Cash. But then you have bands like Gojira X or the Reverend D-Ray and the Shockers who are rocking it out and doing stuff just the way they would do it.
That's excellent. And like you said before, when you get the bands together and during Cash Bash, they're not just playing Johnny Cash songs. They're working it into their set.
Exactly,
as well.
Exactly. So the nice thing is that you get to hear Johnny Cash, but you also get to hear a nice variety of music that you may not be able to hear in Winston-Salem all the time. We've got bands coming from Chapel Hill up in around Baltimore, Richmond. We've got three bands actually coming down from Richmond this year. So it's just a nice variety, but it's also getting to hear original music,
mm-hmm.
which is so important to me as well. Johnny Cash, you know, he did a lot of covers, and especially he's known at the end of taking people's songs and making them his own. Like Hurt. He made those songs a Johnny Cash song. And that's what these guys and girls are doing, is making a Johnny Cash song their own.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes me think of his version of Rusty Cage. We gotta listen to that right now.
I'm gonna break my rusty cage and run.
So do bands just tackle the classics, or do they sometimes play some of the, you know, the newer, like the Rick Rubin-produced American recordings?
It's a mix, but a lot of people do tackle the newer stuff. It's interesting. You'll hear some Johnny Cash songs that you've never heard before because somebody's heard it on an album that he put out in 1962.
He's got so many records. It's one of those.
Exactly. And so there's some that you probably didn't even know he did, you know? And so it's wonderful because it opens up yet another Johnny Cash song to somebody else. Mm-hmm. John Howie Jr., last year I believe it was, he's with John Howie Jr. in the Rosewood Bluff and formerly of Two Dollar Pistols. He did God's Gonna Cut You Down, which is on one of the later albums. Well, originally, Elvis did that song. It's a traditional gospel song, and it's an amazingly fast, upbeat song. The way Johnny Cash did it is ominous.
Yeah.
Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down, tell him that God's gonna cut you down, tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
And John Howie Jr. sort of took the Johnny Cash version of it and just ran with it. Sounded great, and that was a Rick Rubin produced. I think someone did Hurt one year, which is, of course, Nine Inch Nails song that Johnny Cash did with Rick Rubin's producing, and did a great job of it.
What have I become?
my sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end, and you could have it all, my empire of dirt.
So it is a mix. Some of the more country bands, like the Bo Stevens and Mystery Hillbillies, who are on this year, this is their first Cash Bash, they'll probably stick with some of the older ones just because it fits their style better. But, you know.
Do you have a night of Cash Bash, like when you think about it and when you're getting ready to set things up for the next year that you always think about?
The night that I play is usually my favorite night because I get to be on stage and have fun and play. But I like both nights. Friday has tended to be a little more country rockabilly. Then Saturdays is a little more rock and pop kind of stuff. And I enjoy both.
Hey, Porter. Hey, Porter. Can you tell me the time? How much longer will it be till we cross that Mason-Dixon line?
Singer, songwriter, and director of Cash Bash, Richard Boyd. This year's two-night celebration of the music of Johnny Cash takes place on February 28th and March 1st at the Garage in downtown Winston-Salem. Check WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend for more info. For WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia.
Porter, hey Porter, what time did you say? How much longer will it be till I can see the light of day? When Riri Dixon, can you tell that engineer to ring his...
Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts of Try It Arts Weekend, along with pictures and lots of helpful links on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Try It Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.
Hey, Porter, hey, Porter, it's getting light outside. This old train is puffing smoke and a hat strain.